New parents have always loved to snap photos of their babies and share them with anyone in sight. Thanks to social media, they can now share them with practically everybody and instantly. New research looks at the maternal motivations to share baby pictures in the digital age. NPR's Elise Hugh reports.
2-year-old toddler Jackson and his mom, Nicole Jednak, hang out at the Prospect Park playgrounds so often that it feels like this is his backyard. His bouncing around on this balmy Brooklyn day makes for many picture-perfect moments, and mom Nicole knows when to snap them and share them.
I can share with my friends and family a picture of Jack, you know, when he walked for the first time at the park or when he kicked the ball for the first time at the park.
She started an Instagram feed featuring photos of Jack when he was born. She hasn't stopped posting since.
Because we're living in a different era where families are not necessarily living in the same neighborhood, on the same block, seeing their grandparents every Sunday, I think it's a really great way for his grandparents and aunts and uncles and everybody in the family to kind of keep up with what's going on.
Jackson is part of the first generation of kids with digital evidence of their entire lives shared on social media. It starts as early as a sonogram image.
Those children have a digital footprint before they were even born.
Priya Kumar at the University of Michigan wanted to know more about the motivations of moms who post photos of their babies online.
Facebook pictures can give us a really unique lens on not only the transition to motherhood, but also that mother-child relationship.
In interviews with dozens of moms, Kumar found that they share to connect, as Nicole Jednak does, and because they see photo sharing as a social norm. The study further found moms consider 4 main ideas when it comes to posting baby photos. Content, what the photo shows. Audience, who would want to see it. Recency, how recently did I share another picture? And convenience, how easy is it for me to share right now?
She's got 2 older brothers. She's like mad afraid of bigger boys.
For baby Bina's mom, Molly Weingrad, photos of her 3 kids are best shared with family only and kept off all social media. Weingrad emails photo albums to small circles.
Since I don't sort of know where things go and what happens to them after you put them out into the ether, I'd like to keep them private as much as possible.
Privacy concerns did keep moms in the study from posting certain images, like naked photos, and moms were selective about their privacy settings. But even still, Kumar's research shows the audience for baby photos is now much bigger than the days of physical photo albums. That makes parents curators, in a sense, creating a public image of a tiny human that he'll one day have to inherit.
You've got the mother deciding how she wants to portray her own identity online, but she's sometimes doing that through pictures of another person, you know, her child. So is she actually using pictures of the child to kind of represent her own self?
How women negotiate the questions of parental identity and public selves is the work of psychologist Daphne DeMarneff. Her 2004 book, Maternal Desire, explored the complex relationship.
People are grappling with identity, and they're grappling with identity when they become parents, and they're also grappling with identity in terms of who we are online. And so it's sort of this perfect storm in a way of these 2 kind of forces that people are trying to manage.
Jednak, Jackson's mom, says she's put more thought into her photo sharing as Jackson's gotten older.
Now, as he's approaching 2, I post much less frequently, you know, maybe every other day, and before it was 2 or 3 pictures a day. I do think that as he's becoming his own person, it's definitely a line that I need to respect. I don't foresee myself kind of exposing his life in this way for too much longer.
How we expose ourselves, how we present our children, and who we really are. Complicated topics that DeMarneff says deserve more thought.
Our public persona, in a sense, is kind of hard to disentangle from our private self. And those are issues that cultures are always grappling with, and this is just the newest iteration.
The decisions we make to snap photos and share them happen in an instant, but their effects can be much longer lasting. Elise Hugh.
Okay, good to see you.
All right.
NPR News.
Our Planet Money team this week is taking a look at the lowly penny. People discard pennies in bowls by cash registers. They walk by them on the street without a thought of picking them up. In fact, a lot of us don't even pick them up when we drop them. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports that there is one place where people think pennies could really cause some change.
What if, as you were surfing around the internet, there was a way to send really small amounts of money to the people who make the things you like? All those cat videos, recipes, blog posts, news stories. In the early days of the internet, people thought this idea of micropayments was going to be one of the ways the internet paid for itself. Some programmers at Digital Equipment Corporation actually worked on it back in 1997. Did it have a secret code name, this project?
It was always called Millicent. M-I-L-L-I-C-E-N-T.
This is Russ Jones, who was part of the team. What was the smallest amount you imagined someone paying with the system?
We were designing the system so that you could do transactions down to a penny.
It turns out it can be expensive to send pennies around the internet. If you wanted to pay a penny using a credit card, he says, it could cost you 30 cents to send that 1 cent. The Millicent solution was to add up all the small change people would be sending around and pay it to each recipient in a lump. Russ Jones said they did a small test run, gave a bunch of people 10 bucks to spend, and signed up businesses. One guy charged 25 cents to play a virtual guitar. This was early internet days, remember? The Oxford English Dictionary sold definitions for 1 penny. And it worked, but there was this one side effect. It subtly changed the nature of surfing the web. People were used to getting stuff for free. They did not like paying, even small amounts.
One of the things we found out was that people would get as aggravated when something went wrong with a 5 cent purchase as when something went wrong in the real world with a $50 purchase.
Really? Like, that wasn't the word I meant to look up in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, you know, I accidentally keyed in the wrong word and I just lost my penny. I want my money back.
Millicent never made it out of the lab. The internet took a different path. People got paid by sticking ads on their sites or by charging subscription fees. But the idea of pennies is back again. The internet seems to be changing. People are buying stuff for small amounts. A game for your phone for $2, a song for 99 cents. So why not pennies? A big venture capital firm in Silicon Valley is into the idea, and people are trying to make it work again.
Oh, I think it can change. It could be, it would probably be the biggest change since the occurrence of the internet.
This is Linus Olsen, co-founder and CEO of an online payment system called Flatter. Flatter tries to get around the problem that Millicent had of turning web surfing into a kind of unpleasant shopping trip. Flatter makes paying voluntary, like a tip. Basically, you load up your Flatter account with however much money you want to give away in a month, say 10 bucks or whatever. Then, if you see an article or a cat video you like, you click on a little Flatter button. At the end of the month, everyone you flattered splits the money you set aside.
Actually, at the system right now, can do fractions of cents.
Fractions of a penny.
That's how it works right now. So it will be 1 cent in the future.
So make the case that a penny is worth something.
Yeah, it's worth something if there are a lot of people that does the same thing. So we have this saying that we've been using that is a Swedish saying. Många bäckar små blir en stor å.
And it means what?
And it would translate to many small streams forms a large river.
Olsen says people are using Flatter. A lot of folks in Germany signed up.
We have a podcaster who makes his living from this. I think he gets like $5,000 or something.
A month?
Yeah.
Okay. A penny can actually be a lot in the online world. If you try to earn money by putting ads on your website, you get a little bit for every person who comes to your site. How little? If one person sees an ad, you might get 1/1000th or 1/100th of 1 penny. So a whole penny, 1 cent? From that perspective, it is worth picking up from the sidewalk. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Video cameras worn on the body are quickly becoming standard issue for American police, especially at departments which are in the process of reform. That's the case in New Orleans, where the troubled police department is now requiring almost all of its officers to wear the cameras. But as NPR's Martin Costi reports, cameras themselves don't guarantee police transparency.
The New Orleans Police Department has a dark history of corruption, racism, and brutality. The low point may have been the Danziger Bridge episode after Hurricane Katrina, when police shot unarmed people, then covered up the crime. These days, the department is trying to rebuild the public's trust, which is where the body cameras come in.
I just flip this little button here, turn it on. Once I double tap, you hear the little beep. Oh, it's ready to go.
Officer Johnny Brumfeld has just responded to a call in the French Quarter. His camera's mounted on his chest, and he's supposed to record almost all his interactions with the public.
Whenever there's a call for service, right before I engage in contact with the party that calls or any self-initiated contact, right now, it's recording.
And the department brass want the public to know about those cameras.
It's just a win-win.
Ronald Serpas is New Orleans superintendent of police. He's trying to convince a federal court that the department has changed, that it's reformed enough to get out from under a federal consent decree. The cameras are one way of demonstrating the department's spirit of transparency.
A body-worn camera can help us have that unvarnished recreation of what happened. It'll give supervisors an opportunity to say something along the lines of, you know, Mrs. Smith, our officers did not treat your son poorly, and we actually have evidence to that now. Or, you're right, we did not do a good job.
But what happens if an officer stops recording, say, right before Mrs. Smith's son gets roughed up? The chief says that kind of selective recording will not be tolerated.
Clearly, if an officer was to interrupt that by their choice, and they didn't do it any other day that week, they haven't done it any other day that month, it's going to raise a lot of suspicion.
The department's new body camera rules do not spell out the penalty for failing to record, though the chief says a cop can be fired for being untruthful. But in the long run, the bigger problem may be the question of access. Once the videos are made, who gets to see them?
Hey, Lieutenant, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
That's what Ursula Price is about to find out. She works for the Independent Police Monitor. It's the office that investigates potential cases of misconduct. Right now, she's on the phone with the department asking for video of an arrest in which the suspect was bitten repeatedly by a police dog. It's the first time Price has ever asked for a body camera video, and she has high hopes.
I wanted to ask if the dog bite Friday night had any body camera footage. Yeah. Do we know why?
The officer tells her he doesn't know why there's no video. Later, he tells Price that there is video after all, but then it takes 2.5 weeks for her to see it. And that's only after she tells the department about the inquiries from NPR. The department counters by saying it offered Price the video within 3 working days. But she says the whole system for finding out what videos the police have is clunky. And she still hasn't found out how many cameras were rolling at the dog bite incident.
I'm waiting to get confirmation that that one video is the only video available because there should be, if I understand the policy well, more video available. So I'm waiting to hear back about that.
The department tells NPR that at least 2 of the officers there were detectives and they don't wear cameras. Susan Hudson runs the Independent Police Monitor's office. She says she hopes the police will get better at disclosing what videos they have, not just to her, but to the general public.
There has been some problem dealing with NOPD and getting access to things that are public records and people having to sue and judgments against the department and fines and fees and such for not following the public records rules. So that hopefully will get better going forward.
Chief Serpas says he'll add whatever staff is needed to handle public requests for the videos. And these tensions are coming soon to a police department near you. Professor Sam Walker is an expert on police accountability who talks to chiefs all the time.
I've really been struck by the extent to which people just assume this is the coming thing. Just, you know, deal with it.
Cameras are especially appealing to troubled police departments that are under federal scrutiny. Oakland and Los Angeles have tried the cameras. Seattle is planning to. Video lets a department signal its devotion to transparency. But for that to mean something, it can't look like the videos are just there for the benefit of the police. For instance, New Orleans has decided to let officers watch their own videos before writing reports. Walker says that is not a good idea.
One of the problems we've had historically is officers give accounts of incidents that are not factually correct, and they're often covering up their actions. I think the officers should do their reports, and then the recording should be available to supervisors.
If an officer is planning to lie, video is a pretty good guide to what kind of lie he can get away with. And that could feed into a public perception that access to the videos is a police privilege. But so far in New Orleans, most people haven't even noticed the cameras. Lieutenant Travis St. Pierre is walking down Royal Street, demonstrating the new technology to random citizens.
Lieutenant St. Pierre with the police department. How are you today?
Marcus.
You're being recorded right now by one of our cameras that we issued.
What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong. Just want to talk to you, see how you're doing today.
Oh, you can't blame the guy for being a little freaked out. St. Pierre's camera fits over his ear, and the effect is sort of Robocop-y. He trains other cops on the cameras, and he says they've told him that the body cameras are changing behavior now on the part of the public.
They always have this one individual that they would go on calls of service for that likes to be disruptive, curse the police, fight with the police. And when they got out and turned the camera on and informed her she was being recorded, and she immediately said, oh, okay, and it was not a problem at all.
It'll be interesting to see who ends up changing their behavior more in New Orleans, the police or the people their cameras are pointing at. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This week we've been exploring how we remember. Letters, home videos, and of course, the photographs we've taken. Now, here at NPR, few people take or make more photos than Kainaz Amaria. She works with NPR's visuals team. She's a photographer and editor. She joins me in the studio to talk more. Hi there, Kainaz.
Hi, Audie.
So this series was sparked by a conversation about how technology is taking us away from our memories. And we've been talking about the power of images to boost and create our memories in a way, but also that power is diminished when we don't review the pictures. I spoke with the psychologist Linda Henkel about the importance of doing this.
When you're looking at photos, what you're doing is you're reactivating in your brain those mental experiences that you had. You're thinking about what you thought about. You're looking at the color of the shirt. Oh, my gosh, look at how beautiful that blue is. I remember that shirt. I remember this. You're reactivating the neurons that are involved in creating that memory experience. And those are all the things that are going to benefit memory.
Yeah, so when I first heard this, I thought, you know, this is a great argument to make our digital life more analog. We are overwhelmed and consume so many digital images. Actually taking the time to print them out is going to solidify that memory.
So let's talk more about this because I feel inundated by all the images I've taken.
It's overwhelming.
What are some of your strategies for processing all these pictures?
So I would say one word, it's thoughtfulness. Be thoughtful and mindful of what you're doing. When we're making images as photographers, we're thinking about what is in the frame and what isn't in the frame. We're living that moment. It's not passive. That's why we say we make images and not take images. So when I'm making an image, I'm looking at the frame and I'm seeing what's in front of me. I'm editing stuff out that I don't want in the frame and I'm focusing in on what I want to capture. So it's not a snapshot. It's not a burst of images, but I'm there in the moment actually looking at what I'm capturing. And let me tell you, I then remember it.
Now, in understanding sort of how to be mindful in our approach, you mentioned something that you do, which is to value the images that you share, right? And to print them. How does this help?
Yeah, for me, the rule of thumb is if I share it, it's worth printing. That's my editing process, right? When you look at all your takes or what you've done and you've said, okay, I'm going to share this on Instagram, I'm going to share this on Facebook, what you're actually doing is you're editing the images and you're saying, this is worth putting out there in the world. So for me, if I do that, it's then worth printing and putting it in my analog world.
And you've also shared it in other analog ways, right? Like you're a big fan of the Christmas card, which I have to say I kind of... It feels impersonal getting one of 1,000 photos of you and your kids at Christmas time. But you're saying there is a way for this also to be a memory worth building.
Yeah, what I think is awesome about this age is you can really personalize these memories too. I'll tell you a little secret. I love the selfie. When I meet people that I haven't seen in a long time, I make a photo with them, a selfie with them. And this Christmas, I thought of doing something different. I said, you know what? I'm going to print cards with that selfie of the person I'm sending it to on the card. And within a week of me mailing these cards out, I got paragraph-long text messages of my friends and loved ones saying, I loved that card. It reminded me of us together. It's on my fridge. I'm going to frame it. And so never have we been able to personalize and customize our really cherished moments. You can print your images on just about anything now really easily. You can put your Instagram photos on marshmallows and send them out.
Wait, for real?
For real. And actually, the only reason why I know this is because that's what our interns did. They wanted to give us something special when they left. We didn't eat them, but we just thought it was amazing. I mean, you can make posters. You can have little prints. Some of my friends, what they do is they have something automated where every 500 Instagrams, they have it automated so they get a book in the mail after they reach that 500 mark. They don't have to do anything. I remember the days of scrapbooking where I had to buy the corners, buy the tape, buy the ruffled scissors. You know, it took me sometimes 6 months to create an album. It took a really long time. There are apps out there where you can make an image, hit a button, and it'll print it and mail it to you. And it's actually really exciting because everyone's visual language and literacy is being heightened and expanded.
That's Kainaz Amaria. She works as a photographer and editor with NPR's visuals team. You can find Kainaz's tips and tricks for photo taking and, more importantly, photo archiving at npr.org.
It's time for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, good to be here and an early happy Memorial Day.
Likewise. So there are a million ways in which I'm happy that I was done with dating by the time that Facebook and other kind of social media came on the scene. You know, people have to deal with breakups and deleting all those posted happy couple photos. But for people who aren't settled down and don't want to cramp their style on social media, there's an answer. Tell me about the social media prenup.
What an absolutely genius idea. So the idea is that for all the folks who post photos on Facebook or Instagram of their love affair and their great relationship, when it goes south, there should be some way to say, you know what, the really intimate stuff, you can't just post and release. You can't bomb me in that way. And so the idea is up front to do what Kanye suggests that we all do, which is to get a prenup, but this time for social media.
And you know, it can be a serious thing because you mentioned things that are fairly intimate. You know, there's that horrible thing now, revenge porn, when people are posting very intimate pictures of their exes as a way to get back at them.
Very much so. You know, there are about a half dozen state legislatures that have been looking at passing laws to restrict the amount of this kind of social media revenge that can happen. And so this idea of upfront discussing a social media prenup, I think, is a creative one. And a marriage and family therapist couple down in L.A., Sherry Myers and her partner who came up with it, one of the things they've been advising is to have this conversation early such that when you do come up with an interesting photo, an interesting love note, even in that moment, you can say, hey, let's be clear, this is a social media prenup moment, so that everyone's really clear about that.
Now, when we're talking about prenups, are we talking about an actual legally binding document?
Not talking about a legally binding document at the moment. They're saying save the money on the lawyers. But they're saying that the informal agreement is important, or they're pointing the way, of course, not surprisingly, to a couple of apps, one which is called Couple and the other which is called Avocado, which can be part of the enforcement mechanism for saying that post-breakup, this content that we want you to share, you can only get access to it if we both agree.
So something else you can worry about when you're posting something on your smartphone is that we might actually be in danger of running out of the key components used to make smartphones. Those are the rare earth minerals. But Carlos, the answer may lie where?
It may lie on the ocean's floor, some 15,000, 20,000 feet below sea level. As you were saying, most smartphones include about 17 rare earth minerals. You usually can't pronounce the names of them, things like irium and dysprosium and thulium. But the reality is that most have come from mines in China. There's an increasing shortage, plus the Chinese have been playing a little bit of hardball, first with Japan and then with the U.S., not shipping some of it. And it's led a number of people to look below the water for what are these kind of potato-looking rocks that contain some of these very valuable minerals.
Now, is there a reason that we hadn't found those before, or is there an issue with getting to them?
They had been discovered before, if you will, by some British scientists in the 19th century, but it was thought that it was going to be too difficult to extract. And most recently, particularly some of the German scientists have come up with new processes to not only extract these rocks that have the minerals in them, but then get access to the minerals easier and cheaper than you otherwise would.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talk about at npr.org/newandnext. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, great to be with you.
Get ready now as we take you on a voyage to the dark side of the internet, to be precise. There's an entire world that's invisible to your standard web browser. Parts of the internet known as the deep web, the hidden web, the dark web. The tools to get there are just a few clicks away, and more, people who want to browse the web anonymously are signing on. And that's our cover story today, a peek into the hidden side of the internet. Fans of the series House of Cards are probably already familiar with the deep web. It was worked into the plot of season 2. Here, the character Lucas gets a little crash course from one of his reporters.
Hold on, the deep web, I've heard of that.
Oh, yeah, no, 96% of the internet isn't accessible through standard search engines. Most of it's useless, but it's where you go to find anything and everything. Child porn, Bitcoin laundering, mail order narcotics, hackers for hire.
I asked Wired reporter Kim Zetter if House of Cards got it right.
Yeah, but there should be a distinction between what's called the deep web and the dark web.
Let's start there. The terms get a little murky here, but there are two main categories.
The deep web is sort of anything that's not accessible through the commercial search engines like Google and Bing. Things stored in databases that these search engines won't pick up, or things that are behind a subscription firewall like LexisNexis won't get picked up by the search engines.
Then there's the dark net, a specific part of that hidden web where you can operate in total anonymity.
There are a lot of drug sites. They sell weapons, guns, tasers, hacking tools, and even you can hire an assassin. And it's not just illicit activities. We also see political dissidents who have forums that are, let's say, off of the internet grid.
But it's not the forums for dissidents that usually make the news. If you've heard of the dark net, it's probably because of a site called the Silk Road, an underground website famously shut down by the government last fall.
They were selling, you know, just a smorgasbord of drugs, LSD, heroin, methadone. What quite often happens is the ones that get exposed, they make silly mistakes. And in this case, Ross Ulbricht, who's alleged to have been the founder and the owner of Silk Road, made some mistakes in some postings that helped identify him.
Already there's a Silk Road 2 that's popped up to replace the Silk Road. Are they safe as long as they avoid, you know, silly mistakes?
They may be, not necessarily. I mean, sometimes law enforcement gets lucky. There are sometimes ways to locate a server that's hosting. And then what happens is the server may get taken down without any arrests at all. But then it'll pop up again.
So how do you access this hidden part of the internet? Let's go back to that clip from House of Cards.
How do you access it?
It's actually pretty easy. I can show you if you want.
Yeah, I'm curious.
Mind if I...
Go ahead.
Okay, first thing you need is Tor.
Tor is the main browser people use to access this part of the web. It's an acronym for the Onion Router. The Onion refers to the layers you go through to disguise your identity. Tor is free. Anyone can download it. It's a simple site that looks like a Firefox browser, but if you take the right steps, it's very different. When you connect to a site through Tor, your computer goes through a series of other computers and bounces around anonymously until it reaches a destination.
No one will be able to see that you're the one visiting those websites, and the websites will not be able to see that you're the one visiting them either. They will only be able to see that you're using Tor to do something.
Runa Sandvik is a privacy and security researcher. She's a former contractor with the Tor project. Normally, whenever you visit a website, your internet service provider can see that you're visiting that website. Sandvik says that if you use Tor, the location that you appear to be in will change.
You can be in DC and you can send your traffic through Germany, Sweden, and Russia, for example, and the website that you're visiting will see that someone in Russia is visiting their site, not you in DC.
So who created Tor? Some open source hacker activists, right? Nope. It was the U.S. Navy, the Naval Research Lab, to be precise. Again, Runa Sandvik.
The purpose was initially to protect the communications of the U.S. military. But the challenge here is if you have this anonymity system, and every traffic going into the system is the U.S. Navy, and everything that pops out of the system is the U.S. Navy, then you're not that anonymous. Hmm. So by opening up the system to everyone, different groups of people can hide in a big crowd of anonymous Tor users.
Now, when we hear about Tor in the news, it usually is connected with some sort of sordid activity. Do we have a sense of how much of Tor activity is about illicit activity?
No. So Tor was developed with this concept of privacy by design. There is no way you can figure out who's using Tor to do what or how many websites of a certain category exist within the Tor network.
We don't know how many of these illicit sites exist, but a new search engine accessible through Tor is starting to gather that information the way Google does. It's called Grams. Wire's Kim Zetter reported on it.
It looks exactly like Google, with the same colorful lettering and grams. It even has an I Feel Lucky button. We tested it, and it showed up some high-quality heroin. Mm-hmm. You can find guns. The listings will tell you where the seller is, what country, so you can know where it's coming from when you order it. And they were also talking about putting in customer reviews of the vendors.
You talked to the creator of the site. What was his motivation behind this?
Well, he saw that people were having trouble locating what they wanted and also distinguishing between the reputable sellers and the disreputable ones.
Now, do tools like Grams that make the darknet more accessible to more people, does that also make those areas more susceptible to being found out by law enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, the quiet sites go under the radar, and Silk Road got on the radar after it was covered by the Gawker website, and that caused people in Congress to point the Justice Department to it and demand that they do something about it. So, yeah, obviously when something becomes prominent, it's going to get into the crosshairs of law enforcement.
But Runa Sandvik says there's a lot more going on than criminal activity.
There's human rights activists, journalists, military, law enforcement, normal people. It just really depends on what you want to do.
Tor's executive director is working with victims of domestic abuse who need to communicate without being tracked by their abusers. Tor is also used by Chinese dissidents who can't access sites like Twitter, and it became a valuable tool during the Arab Spring.
We saw that the numbers were skyrocketing. For example, in Iran, Tor usage went from 7,000 users in 2010 to 40,000 users 2 years later. And in Syria, from 600 users to 15,000 users in just 2 years.
Tor use jumped again in the last year, since the revelation of the NSA surveillance program. Sandvik estimates that there are close to 1 million daily users worldwide. With Americans increasingly concerned about being monitored online by corporations or their government, that number is certain to grow.